Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, your host, and this is a program where we talk to writers and find out more about their lives and how they do what they do to give us the wonderful creations that they come up with. First, of course, I would like to remind you that I have a website. It's manzamedia.com. That's manzamedia.com. And I have tried to post a few new things there, especially, let's see, one of the more recent shows that I did was on the drug abuse issue with methamphetamine, the problem that's going on around the country that we think is so important, and Manzanita Writers Press and I are very concerned, and we want to try to do what we can to get the public involved to find a way to combat this problem in our neighborhoods and in our areas. So on my website, you'll find a little bit of information. The article that I wrote in the Calaveras Enterprise about the meeting that we sponsored a few weeks ago with Scott Thomas Anderson. And on the previous show, I read some poems that people have commented on. They really liked these poems. I got them from a website that was, familyfriendpoems.com. You can go there and find them. They are, the first one was Michael. She wrote about her brother who was being admitted to a hospital with a drug overdose. The title of the poem is Michael, and Julie Lee is the author. And she was writing about her brother. The second one was Because He Loves Cocaine by Melissa Scott. She was writing about her husband who was an addict. There are some other very touching poems on that website, and not just about drug addiction. Oh my goodness, if you need a poem or if you're looking for a poem on just about any subject that touches humankind, it's a wonderful website, familyfriendpoems.com. And as I said, I have other things on the website too. Hope you go there and check it out. Now, it's time for morning workout. And today I have a poem that was sent in by my friend Sandy Trezise. She's been a guest here on the program. She is a member of Writers Unlimited with us. And she said, oh, I finally got brave enough to send you something. I'm really glad you did, Sandy. What she's writing about in this poem, which is called Freshly Baked Bread, is about our sense of smell, which is really powerful, and it brings back memories that parts of our subconscious don't fully reveal sometimes. So that's what this poem's about. Freshly Baked Bread. Why am I weeping? Odd response to a familiar aroma. I've smelled it before, rising up from Gina's bakery three floors below. All it usually does is make me hungry, make me want to leave my warm bed, dress quickly, descend the creaking stairs to the back door of Gina's aromatic kitchen before the crowds arrive. I close my eyes, hoping the back of my eyelids will display the memory that lays open my emotions so acutely. Nothing appears. The screen remains dark. No matter, I must live with the mystery. Let the cause expose itself when it is ready. Until then, there is the comfort of Gina's kitchen. That's really nice, Sandy. Thank you very much for that. Now, the next poem I'm going to read, I'm going out on a limb here because the person who wrote it is sitting right across from me. He is half of my team of guests today, Charlotte Muse and Patrick Daly, and we're going to talk to them in just a moment. But Patrick has a chapbook called Playing with Fire, and I love all the poems in this chapbook, and I thought I would read one of them. It's called A Common Egret. I hope I do it justice. I have to sing. Oh, no, we don't want to drive the listeners away. Oh, dear. Okay. We'll leave that out. That would be the last three lines I should sing? Okay, we'll just pretend I sing. Okay, A Common Egret by Patrick Daly. I saw an egret startle, spread wing, wide as the path, grace, ease. But I saw it drag itself, a sack, up the rocking ladder air into a place whose freedom spirits have. I saw a new place in the heart, found readily, as after a rain, sun on the bone, edges of the ivy leaves outside your door. Though I admit in my heart no place where wings spread innocently, all hawk-hunted, seeded with evil, still I stand here on your doorstep and singing. A new place, a light heart, open your door and kiss me. I didn't sing those last three lines, but oh, they're so nice. dare I ask, was that written for Charlotte?
It was.
Charlotte, you're a lucky woman.
I know.
No, I'm a lucky man.
All right, well, I didn't really welcome both of you before, so welcome Charlotte Muse.
Thank you.
And welcome Patrick Daly.
Thank you.
The husband and wife team, both poets, both with chapbooks and awards and lots of wonderful things. I'm so glad to have you here. Let's see. Charlotte, we'll start with you first. You earned your Master of Arts and your MFA in creative writing at San Francisco State.
Yes, I did.
And you've also taught there. You taught creative writing and poetry. And you taught poetry for UC Berkeley Extension and other places as well. And you are the author of two chapbooks. The one we're going to be talking about today is A Story Also Grows. But you also wrote The Comfort Teacher. What is that about?
Well, that was my first chapbook, and it didn't have any one theme particularly. It has a long poem called The Comfort Teacher. And it has several others, too. So it was just a small collection, you know, the first one that I got published.
When did you publish it?
Gee, it was back in the 1980s, I think.
1984, I think.
Was
oh,
it?
Really?
Yeah. I don't remember. But, yeah, it was done, though, by the Hayek Press, which makes beautiful handmade books. Robin Hayek made it. It's part of her little Flowering Quince series of chapbooks. So.
Oh, sounds nice.
Yeah, it was nice.
Yes. Is it available anywhere, if anyone would
I
like
think
to?
There are still some copies online and everything, but...
online,
yeah.
Where?
And I guess I probably have some, but anyway, yeah.
If someone wanted to go and get this book and others online, where would they go?
Well, the best place would be to go on my website, mm-hmm. which is charlottemuse.net, and you know, it tells you how to order any book. If you can just contact me and
wonderful. So will you autograph it?
Sure.
Wonderful.
<Anytime.
laughs> Great. Okay, and then you co-authored a chapbook called Trio.
Yes, it's there were two other people, Tony Morosevich and Edward Smallfield, and I. We all three taught at San Francisco State, and so if this is a small collection, like of three of us all together. We each did our own, and anyway, it was fun.
Yeah. What years did you teach at San Francisco State?
Oh, let's see. I taught for 7 years there, starting in I think 1990. Or something like that, and then through the year 2000, and I taught at for UC Berkeley Extension for like 20 years, the same time, and into I think I stopped doing it somewhere like 2005 or something like that. And I've taught lots of different groups of people. Cancer survivors and their caregivers and teens at risk. I love that.
you really like that, huh?
I really did. I got the kids to really like an 18th century poem called Well, it's out upon it, I have loved three whole days together and am like to live love three more if it prove... Anyway, it's that poem.
If it prove fair weather.
If it prove fair weather, time... Anyway, I
and
won't go on.
And you got kids to like this.
Well, they asked me, what does out upon it mean? And I said, well, it means something like dude. You know, because they called it the dude poem. And I told them about how they'd be wearing, you know, like white stockings and frock coats and satin things and everything, and this was like a way in the 18th century of, you know, it was bragging, I can get lots of girls, and, you know, here I've been in love with the same girl for three whole days, but I can get, you know, hundreds more any time, and they just loved it, so they kept saying, let's read the dude poem again.
Oh, wonderful.
That was funny.
Now, thinking about that poem, when you taught it, how did you read it to them first, and then have them read it, or and then talk about its meaning, or how did you approach that?
Well, I let them read. You know, someone would always volunteer to read it, and then, you know, they would read it, and they would not understand some things like out upon it, or, you know. So I would just let them read it, and then I would kind of go a little bit through it and say, well, now, of course, you know that this means, you know, that just kind of clarify things. Uh-huh. And anyway.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. We're out of time for our first segment, so we'll be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We are talking today with Charlotte Muse and her husband Patrick Daly. And Charlotte and I were just waxing poetic about teaching poetry. I was telling her during the break that I used to, when I taught sixth grade, I really enjoyed working with my students on poetry. And I was kind of looking for some tips from her, even though I don't teach anymore. But we'd better get back to what we were doing, because one thing I forgot to do is ask the two of you. Some years ago, the two of you created a radio program down in the Bay Area, and it was in Cupertino on KKUP, which is an FM station, and you called it Out of Our Minds. Where did you get the idea for that?
It just... They wanted a title for it, and we just came out of our minds.
out of our minds. And it was on weekly?
Wednesdays.
Yes, it was. And it was, as you know, it's quite a commitment to do a live radio show every week.
Yes, it is.
We had some really interesting experiences.
We used to claim we were the only primetime poetry radio show in America. It probably wasn't true. No,
I bet you were, though. I mean, yeah, prime time. So you were on in the afternoons or evenings?
In the evenings.
In
8
the
o'clock.
Evenings. 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
Ooh, are any of those recordings still around? Or
we have some.
You do?
Boxes of tapes in the garage. These were the days when they didn't have...
Yes. Yeah, well, that's wonderful. How long did you do it?
Oh, a good 7 or 8 years.
Maybe 10, I think.
Might have been. We did it just us for a while, and then we started getting a friend of ours who's since died, a good poet, Jim Standish, to take one weekend of the month, one day of the month.
Uh-huh.
And then gradually we sort of handed over to him because he wanted to do it. And they moved the station. We were telling you about the little funky garage that we started out in.
Oh, yeah.
That literally, I mean, across the way was another building exactly the same that actually was a service garage. So that's what that'll give you an idea of the size and shape of it.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, then they moved it to somewhere that was a lot harder for us to get to. And we sort of, so we gradually
phased out. And the traffic was getting worse down in the Cupertino area.
Yeah, and this is, they moved it to Santa Clara, and it was...
Oh,
And there was a guy with a leaf blower who used to, for some reason, at 8 o'clock at night, he'd turn on the leaf blower.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that wouldn't go over well.
Yeah.
Well, did you read your own poetry on that show, or did you read other people's poetry, or interview people?
We
rarely
read
our own, or maybe once in a while.
Yeah.
But it was, we tried to design different, you know, we had... we had lots of different ideas and different poets coming in, and
much like you do.
Much like you
oh,
do.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Just to come in. But one thing we did do that I enjoyed doing, and hope the listeners did, we would have an opening segment called Poems Guaranteed to Make You Like Poetry.
Yes. And we would read a poem that we were sure people would
like.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I would love to see some of those.
Yeah. Well,
and you never know what people are going to love. Well, you know that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Calls that you get, but my very best memory on along those lines was I had just discovered in American Poetry Review some poems by Paul Zweig, who had just died, but he left these poems, and he was a friend of Galway Canal, and then American Poetry Review published these last 12 of his last poems, and they were wonderful.
Mm.
But they were, you know, I thought they were sort of poets' poems, and we were reading them. We were both reading them on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and someone called in and said, "Boy, those are just great." And so we talked a little bit, and I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm a mechanic. You know, I'm actually listening to this under the car as I work on it."
Oh, wonderful. Well, it's great, isn't it, when you get a response from someone like that?
From someone like that, yeah. Who you don't think is part of your natural audience at all.
Uh-huh. It has a greater appeal than you think it does.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Well, that's really interesting. When I saw that you had been radio show hosts, I thought, I've got to talk to these people. Now, Charlotte, going back to your teaching, you've taught so much. What have you learned from it?
Well, the main thing I've learned is that what people write is endlessly surprising and endlessly inventive, and that what we call a talent in writing, I think, really comes down to receptivity and a sense of life, a willingness to let what you say come through all the filters that we have, you know, and you can learn to do that. You can learn to be more receptive. Anyway, I think it involves a willingness to kind of watch the world and to make yourself be sort of the living pen that writes the poem. It's sort of, many poets, I think, have the feeling that a poem comes through them. As if you were just the, I don't know, not quite. I mean, you have to work hard at it too.
You do.
You know, it's not like you're sitting there waiting to be, you know, once in a while you get a gift. A poem does seem to just come.
Yeah.
But anyway, I learned more from my students actually than I taught them, I think. But there were some things that I wanted to teach people, and this is one thing that I'm fanatic about. It's not a sexy idea, but it's the idea of syntax, because so much of contemporary poetry is set in the present tense,
mm-hmm.
often the first person present tense, and a lot of times, you know, we all sound like Dick and Jane on steroids or something. I do this, I do that, I do, you know, and I think that it's a very strange and kind of complex reason for that, because the past is sort of the place of memory, where we remember, and the future we have to project into. It's the place of imagination and expectation,
mm-hmm.
and we seem to be ignoring these faculties. And I think that since, in a way, the present doesn't exist, really. It's always, you know, whenever I say now, it's not now anymore, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
I think we're like people inching along a ledge, refusing to look, you know, either before us or in back of us. And I think that despite our terror, I think we are in the grip of something that makes us terrified to look either way.
Do you think that's our society?
I think it's the world, you
is
know.
It, is it the way human beings are today in these times with so much going on, so many threats, so many, and we know them all. There have always been threats, but we know them all now instantaneously.
Is that why we're reluctant to be
introspective?
That's a very interesting point, and I do think that has a lot to do with it. And And also, you know, we're also lonely because, yeah. you know, here we're all connected to our machines, and here we also are, as you say, being constantly aware of all the threats around us. And I think that despite our terror and our paralysis, we have a duty as poets to try to remember and reimagine the past and to try to re-envision or to envision the future. You know, if we don't do it, we're letting go of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we have to try to look beyond ourselves or at least at our world. Sometimes this might take the form of stating what seems obvious to us, that we're afraid, that the world seems to be crumbling,
mm-hmm.
that we can no longer imagine a better future. And if we really believe these things, I think we have to learn to say them. At least that's the start. You know, even to say obvious things like that, you know, in our poetry, besides just focusing on, you know, I'm doing this now, or I can't,
Facebook. Facebook is notorious for that, people just connect with each other all the time, but they don't say anything.
They don't say anything. No, I know.
You know, I got up and
I'm at the store.
Today.
I just, you know, and movie stars or something saying stuff like that as if people...
It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any depth. And I think you're right. I think we have all become so busy. Do you know anyone who does not say that they are really busy?
Very few people. No.
Yeah, because we all are. We're so busy. But what are we doing?
Yeah.
And we have given ourselves no time for introspection or reflection. And that's where you have to go to be able to really create something.
This is true, yeah.
You have to push all of that away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Anyway, I think it's good, since you mentioned, I think in some of my workshops I make people memorize poetry, because you mentioned that you did that for your students, and
uh-huh.
it's good. It keeps it in your head. Whatever keeps it in your head, it's good.
And what a gift that is. I mean, yeah. I can remember poems that I had to memorize when I was in grade school. They come back to me now, and people don't do that anymore. They might know the words to a popular song, but they never recite it as poetry, and they don't have anything to draw on, words that some other great writer wrote in the past that they can bring to their fore to comfort them in a time when they don't have their own words for anything that has happened.
Beautifully said, Linda. Well, I think that's what I would have said if I could have thought it.
Well, I love that. We'll break now, because I can't do any better than that. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. I'm talking right now with Charlotte Muse, and she has written several chapbooks. Before we get any further, I want to explain to you what a chapbook is, for those of you who are not familiar with them. It's not a C-H-A-T book. It's a C-H-A-P book, as in chapter. And we're not sure, but I think chapbook might come from the idea that a chapbook is short. It's certainly less than 100 pages.
Yeah.
Maybe less than 80.
Yeah.
It's about the size of a chapter, and it's usually a book of poetry, usually on the same theme. And the chapbook that we want to talk with Charlotte about today is this very important one that she wrote called A Story Also Grows. And these are poems centered around the life of a woman who lived in the valley south of the Bay Area, where you're getting down toward Monterey. It's an area, well, the city that's there now is Gilroy. And Californians will know about the Gilroy Garlic Festival that happens every year. That's where this woman lived. Her name was Ascension Solorzano de Cervantes. And I probably murdered her name. But she was an American Indian woman, and did something very important. She lived from, I think, 1855 to 1930, and she became very important to her tribe and to all of us. In fact, the book of poems that Charlotte has written about her. There is a copy of it in the Smithsonian. It's a specially created book. And there's also one, of course, in the Library of Congress. So you take it from there, Charlotte. Tell us about Asuncion.
Well, Asuncion was really interesting because her family basically was born into the Stone Age. And they were subjugated by Spanish missionaries, and they built the mission San Juan Bautista. Hmm. They were the Mutsun tribe. And so Doña Asuncion, you know, her grandparents built the mission and worked there for years, and her parents did, and her parents had a little farm. And so she saw, I mean, her family, and she saw the end of both the Spanish period, and then the Americans came in, you know, and took over, and then the modern period, you know, after the missions were abolished, the Americans came, and so she saw huge changes. Mm-hmm. And also, when she, I got a friend gave me this unpublished manuscript of John Harrington, a famous Smithsonian ethnologist, and Asuncion thought she was dying, and she was a famous healer. She went and put on her black dress and got in bed and prepared to die. Mm. But she didn't die. A lot of people came to support her and everything. So they sent for John Harrington to come out from the Smithsonian, and she spent the next 8 months telling all the stories she could about her life and her language. She was the last fluent native speaker.
Mm.
And so he wrote it all down, and I got a copy of some of her stories, and I tried to write the poems based on those.
They're wonderful. And if you'd like to know about it more about Asuncion, go to just Google Ama, A-M-A-H, Mutsun, M-U-T-S-U-N. You will find out a lot more about Asuncion, her people. You'll see a map of where they lived. It's very informative. So we'll let you do that on your own while Charlotte is going to tell us more about her experience with her and her poems.
Okay, well, maybe I'll tell you where the title comes. It's from a quote by her. A story also grows. It never remains the same. Though one wants to tell it the same as one heard it, one always puts in a word more or less. And there are many people in this world who are great gossips. They fix up a story very nice, even if they don't know it. So that when a story has passed through the lives of many people, surely it is already impossible to tell what story it is, for it is already changed fundamentally. And when the story is written or made into a book, it is still a story and nothing more, she said. But anyway, she was a wonderful woman, and people came from all over the world to be healed by her. She never turned anyone away. She never asked for payment. Hmm. She just took whatever people gave her.
Hmm.
So anyway, she was a wonderful lady. So maybe I could read, shall
please.
I read a couple poems?
Yes, please do.
Okay, well, I started with this one, Half-Breed, and I would take a quote from Asuncion and then kind of write the poem from that. So her quote is, "One of the ranchers in the hills of Raymond had a she-dog, and the coyotes used to come down in the middle of the night to visit that she-dog. And now just listen, that she-dog gave birth to half-breeds of dog and coyote. And when Tony was over there herding sheep, they had one of those dogs." That's what she said. So, half-breed. "You can bend half a coyote to herding sheep, not a whole one. After they trained the half-breed, he was good at his job. The dog half wouldn't harm the sheep. The coyote had an eye out for trickery. He was wild with suspicion, crazy with it, but he kept the sheep in line. Dog obedient, coyote watchful, both parts ready to run. There was one who didn't trust fences. The coyote knew nothing of regret, and the dog sang only out of pain, until each half taught the other how to sing. If you ever heard that half-breed at night, you didn't want to leave him alone with the moon." So I'll just keep reading.
Please
do. Okay.
"In
the well. They were digging a well in front of the San Juan Church, and my grandfather was a boy 12 years old, and he was down in the well digging. Asuncion, Solarsino. In the well. They put me to work down there because I was strong and small enough, 12 years old. I began digging in the early morning while the well was like a cup of light. Slowly, gradually, shadows drank it up, until past noon there was none left, only darkness, the chill and smell of clay, the scrape of my shovel, little waterfalls of soil. That was all. I looked up to tell them to pull out the bucket, and I saw the stars shining in the daytime. Who would believe this is possible? I can tell you I shook with the knowledge, as if it were a thing too large to hold. They had to get me out of the well. I was afraid I had traveled so far out of myself I might not find the way back. But I returned to make the usual journeys. I'm an old man now, and I tell my grandchildren that behind the sun the stars are always shining, like a secret the sun tries to hide. The stars don't set. I tell them that though I worked under the lash at San Juan, though I was young, still a child, the earth gave this knowledge to me. Turning bear. A man that used to turn bear they called Orima. No, they did not put on bear skins, the bear doctors did not. It was in the very fire itself that they used to turn into bears. And as soon as they finished, they would take to the country in order to kill animals or for doing damage. Ascension Solorzano. Turning bear. Something of bear they wanted drove them to make a fire and dance until they were filled up with bear's ways, breathing with a bear's growl, hunched over with their stomachs loose. They'd let the drool run down. They didn't care. Some said they were thinking of what they could kill, and others of how they would eat it. When the last part of themselves was gone and only bear looked out of their eyes, they'd throw themselves down on all fours and roll right into the flames. Their face bones melted to a hairy black nose snout with two pebbles glittering above long teeth. The rest of the bear would grow from that. When they staggered at last out of the fire, mean from pain, everyone would back away. We'd tell the young people, you don't want to be a bear doctor, stay away from it. But you could see them trying to follow with their eyes the exact moment when someone turns bear. Nobody can see that. We can only point afterwards to the rows of claws, each a small knife, to the huge muscles and heavy fat, and say, look what they do. Now, this next one has bad words in it. Am I allowed to say bad words on the radio?
Mr. Giddy, is she allowed to say bad words?
Well, there's the F word.
No.
Okay. Sorry, I don't usually swear in poems.
Just about anything but the F word.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know what? Maybe I'll read it and I'll
okay. I'll just, know what it is.
Yeah. Bleep it out.
It's a fudge. Right? Okay, well.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. They said that long ago men used to go and throw rocks at the great horned owls just to tease them and make them talk. They said bad words, and at last the great horned owls would answer back. The owls used to fight with the men until they scratched them. Ascension Solorzano. It's kind of about bad words. That's why I was raised in a convent. I just want to say that. There was a tree where the owls used to gather and sing. Ooh, ooh, the owls in the tree. Ooh, they'd croon. Forget about the hunt. We only want each other and the moon. We owls are going to tell the night what song is and how much we love the late. Who hasn't wanted a strong branch and company to sit with in starlight and sing? Who, hoo, the owls with the horns doing the great horned owl doo-oo, doo-oo. But over in the village, men and boys got together. It's a slow night, nothing going on. Let's go take on the owls. Silent as water, they seeped through the grasses, and pow, they exploded right near the owl tree. Ho, owls, you sing through your asses. You can't tell a song from a fart. The song slid away and went to look for someone merry. The owls sat silent as clocks, all their yellow eyes glaring out from feathered sockets. Then, we lords of the dark wing, lords of the hunt, far seers, stone-clawed makers of the moon's own music, ask you, why do you provoke us? But the men spoke no owl. They picked up rocks. Stupid birds, just want to sit up there and yodel? The owls flew down in fury. You ruin! You ruin! The men only laughed and clubbed them away. A few scratches later, they went home. "Fudge you, fudge you, fudge you," the owls shrieked at the jangling air. They never came back to the tree. That song in that place is gone. But they bided their time until they got a man alone and swarmed at his face and killed him, then pulled out his eyes. That's what happens when. Who called the dark down? Was it already there, coming out of nowhere to dye the story black? Or does anybody know? I wish I knew. Someone who can tell a different story.
Charlotte News, A Story Also Grows. We're back with Manzanita Voices, and we've been hearing poetry from Charlotte News, but now we want to go to Patrick Daly. He is a poet as well, and wonderful one, has his chapbook called Playing with Fire. And Patrick, you write poetry on your lunch hour.
That's right, yes. And actually what I really do is for weeks and alas sometimes months go by when I work for a software startup when there just isn't any lunch hour. So what I actually more likely do is when I have an idea for a poem, I write it down, whether I really have time to do that or not. And I figure if it takes a little longer than a lunch hour, they owe it to me, because there's been, as I say, I hope no one from my work is listening, but but there's been months when they've had 10 hours of my day. But I actually do try as a discipline to at least take, when it gets to be around the middle of the day, to at least open my notebook and write something. And that's, I write in my journal every day, and also, that's in the morning, and then in the middle of the day, I try to at least, I have a little reminder that says, did you write anything, and I have to answer yes or no. So that's what I make myself do. I actually, open my notebook, and even if it's a sentence saying, I don't have time to do this today, I write it.
You write it. Well, good for you. Well, having read your chapbook, I'm glad you make time for it, because I really like your poetry.
Thank you.
And I'm going to be quiet now and let you go ahead and do whatever you'd like.
Well, I thought I would start and read a poem that has a bearing on what Charlotte was saying about the use of the present tense and what it's symptomatic of. I've had the benefit of Charlotte's advice and criticism even more than her students have had, of course, and I'm can't say how grateful I am for it. But I remember I came back from I'd actually been to Squaw Valley, Writers Workshop 1 year, and I'd brought a handful of poems back by people that I was particularly impressed with. And Charlotte looked at them and said, "Yeah, they are good, but they're all in the present tense," and that made me think about it. And I've sort of consciously tried to broaden the range of tenses that I use, and therefore the range of sort of psychological possibilities, and it's really true. So anyway, this is I guess sort of an Ars Poetica. It's called Play Me a Song, and it's also there's a child in this, and that's our adored granddaughter Janessa. I don't mention her name, but that's who it is. Play me a song. Not the one that just noodles along in familiar riffs in the present tense. Nothing gone, nothing coming. Key changes that never broke a heart. Enough of that. Play notes that walk like there's some place to go, and notes that know you have two hands when there's nowhere. Sing now, only now, to those who won't die. But sing me the endings. Not that I mind seeing of the stranger only his shadow, his moonlight shadow. I know the rest. But time's knife is for cutting. Show me the fruits, limbs, even their memories scooped up and trashed. Spill them from the left hand. Empty the dream of home and plenty and olive-strewn shade. Wake me up sobbing. In the right hand, play something nice. Like that robin, a child was whistling, sagging in her steps, all the hot walk home till it came out right. I thought I'd go on with a poem that's sort of about, it really was written on a lunch hour, and it's sort of about writing a poem on a lunch hour, amongst other things. It's called Playing with Fire, and it is the title poem from the chapbook.
Oh, okay.
On a flat concrete roof somewhere, hot probably because a loose shirt with deep delta sleeves makes sails of him, he raises, then stretches out his arms, and the crowd sways and chants under duress of rigid phrases you can pick out from this foreign language, slogans like oar strokes, quite unlike swift ripples of talk that disappear half-formed, sounds high on the roof of the mouth, straining at the whole weight of what can't be said, need a crowd, fires even, dotted across the restless twilight of the city. And though it has clouded in my lunchtime window, leaving nothing of this but an undulant memory of leaf shadows swallowed in grey, I want the sounds to go on, these crowds and clouds that tempt the mouth as rain-sprung grass seduces the feet. And the story. Isn't it the story of his life that keeps a man running across his lawn, chasing blackbirds from the raspberry bushes, saying to himself, how can this end? Why should it stop? Because the light dims. I want to know what happens when the soldiers come. What is in the mind of the lieutenant who gives the order to fire? A plastic bullet will divide a face in two. A wider choice than the infantryman's picking out a target? You can't tell if you are not there, and you can't tell if you are. Your own story is already out of reach. The woman passing and repassing the doorway will never enter. There is not enough room in the elastic universe to bend things so far. Even those hit in the heart or the head will know they are dying in more worlds than one. Though the censor tomorrow morning will cut much of what can be remembered, though the lunch hour is up, nothing once moved ever stops.
That was quite a lunch hour.
That was a good lunch hour.
I don't think he had time to eat.
This is a poem that is called Bench, that I've gotten to the point where I like it, and this actually is, it's good to know. I started this poem more than 10 years ago, and it was probably about twice as long, and it's actually been published at a length of probably two-thirds, you know, one and two-thirds, whatever, long. And gradually I've sort of, and it goes with the poem, I've sort of whittled it down. But I think it's a good exercise in, you know, people think, well, I've written this now and it's been published, I can't keep working on it. But I wasn't ever happy with it. And now I think I am. It's called Bench.
Okay.
It's just a little poem, but I think I like it now. A surprise in the long green meadow we'd come, tired of climbing out of the woods down upon, glistening new oak wood, waiting for us to sit. It turned our backs on the lights of the meadow, so perhaps whoever set it here wanted us to look down into the brush and the scrub oaks, the thickening shade, the path downward, thought of us resting, not staying. I thought it might have been one of those oaks, fallen, cut up, smooth, remade, and how the benchmaker must have seen both tree and wood, seen himself bringing it back, sturdy and polished, to stand where it fell in the winter winds, a made thing among unfinished things.
Very nice. And it's a lot shorter than it was originally.
It's a lot shorter. It's been whittled and honed and smooth. Here's one that I like. This is the poem that was in The Place That Inhabits Us, which, although we say it ourselves, is a really good anthology.
Yeah,
not because not you know, that's not totally blowing our
can
own horn.
Can people get that from
yes,
you?
Yes, that's published by 16 Rivers Press, which is a cooperative, and they're very good. You know, they publish very good stuff, and it was a very well thought out anthology. I mean, they have poems by Walt Whitman in there, and also some excellent Bay Area poets.
It's sold out its first printing.
Sold out its first two or three printings.
Yeah, I think they're doing it again.
Yeah.
Wonderful. 16 Rivers Press.
16 Rivers Press.
A Place That Inhabits Us.
The Place.
The Place.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so they were all poems either written or, I mean, they were set in the Bay Area, I guess. And this is Deborah Butterfield, casts horses from driftwood. And they're wonderful, at least the one that I've seen in real life that you can all see in the Cantor Gallery on the Stanford campus is just a wonderfully exciting sculpture.
On the South Campus of what?
On the Stanford campus.
Oh, Stanford campus, okay.
So the poem is called Bronze Horse Cast from Driftwood, Do Not Touch, because you really want to touch it. These are the trees the wind blew down. This is the wood that rivers washed away and waves brought back. These are the limbs scattered and collected. This is the mind, and these are the hands. This is the clay casing. This is the wood burned away, and this the metal sputtering into the mold. These are the ashes brushed away, and the metal is turned to branches. These are trees recollected in metal, purged to their effigies, shaken free of themselves, swept up into horse. This is the horse recollected in branches, lashing in the mane, the tail, the belly. This is the horse of the hands, of water, wind, and metal. This is the horse standing lifelike. In the mind, the dead stand like this, turning to look. This is the horse turning to look, to bite at a fly, so lifelike. A notch for an eye, so lifelike, how can you bear not to touch?
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's a wonderful, it's really worth going, you know, from this area, going down and looking at that. It's in the foyer of the Cantor Gallery on the Stanford campus, which is free to go to.
Oh, we'll have to do that. Yeah. We have time for one more short one.
One more short one, all right. Okay. So I will read. That's way too long. I'll read The Bird in My Eye, and I will tell you that I actually have a floater that's like a bird, and it just suddenly appeared one morning, and everyone said, "Oh, it'll go away," and it hasn't. So of course, eventually, I had to write a poem about it. And
so you see it all the time.
I've gotten used to it, but it's there. And so I sort of tried to think about it in a slightly larger, more philosophical sense, since it seems to be part of me now. The bird in my eye. Of course I know it makes me see things wrong. Those people waiting at the railroad crossing, their looks of distress, some holding their ears. It was only the train, not something terrible. Before dawn, masked men. We were not watching a sledgehammer smashing a doorknob, the father dragged out by the neck and his sons after him. The bird made me think I saw that. I was there. Only the bird darkened the gentle light. I didn't see the daughter outside the jail waiting. I want to talk about the goodness of people, the tenderness, what we share beyond the dark. But the bird gets in the way. Not that it was always there, not like the rings of a tree. There was a time before the bird. I should have spoken up then. When I wake in the morning, I roll my eye until the bird floats in stately like a condor. I think it helps to keep it in view. But I'm wrong again. Last night and all through the slow dawn until the radio woke me, I do not know where the bird went or what it did, or if its darkness is grief or blood.
Patrick Daly, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us on.
Oh, it's been wonderful. It's been too short, too, and Charlotte News. You're going to have to come back.
Well,
this
love
is
to.
A standing really, invitation.
Thank you.
We would like to have you come back whenever you are able. And they came up from the Bay Area, listeners, so this was a bit of a drive for them, and it's a very stormy, rainy day. They did spend the night up in
we
this
actually
area.
We had a wonderful time. We love it up here.
Well, I'm so glad, and I do want you to come back because we didn't have enough time for both of you, and so.
Well, thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Linda.
We wouldn't have missed it for anything.
We really wouldn't have.
Well, wonderful. Well, to everyone listening, thanks for coming in and joining us this week, and I look forward to seeing you next week on Manzanita Voices. Take care.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.